chapter 6, beginning in verse 31. And he said unto them, Come ye yourselves apart into a desert place, and rest a while. For there were many coming and going. They had no leisure, so much as even to eat. They departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, many knew him, and ran afoot there out of all of the cities, and out went them, out ran them, and came together unto him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people. He was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep, not having a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, This is a desert place, and the time is far past. Send them away. By now, this is the disciples' favorite plaque. Send them away, that they may go into the country round about, into the villages, and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. He answered and said unto them, Give ye them to eat. They said unto him, Shall we go and buy 200 denarii of bread and give it to them? 8 months' wages is the idea. He said unto them, How many loaves have ye? Go and see. And when they knew, they said, We have 5 loaves and 2 fish, 5 English muffins and 2 sardines. That's what they have. And he commanded them to make everybody sit down by companies upon the green grass. And they sat down in ranks by hundreds and fifties. When he had taken the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and brake the loaves and gave to them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fishes, dividing he among them all. And they did all eat and were filled. They took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of fishes. They that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. That's not humans. That's 5,000 males. Matthew says, plus women and children. So 10,000. Easy. Glutted. Filled. This miracle recorded in all 4 Gospels. That's something we always want to take note of. It's the only miracle before the resurrection recorded in all 4 Gospels. Something about it so staggering, so impressionable, so moving in regards to God's heart and the writer's hearts that it ends up in all 4 Gospels. Now, Matthew was an eyewitness. He was there, and John was an eyewitness. He was there. Mark, writing under, being influenced, writing under the Spirit, but Peter's tutelage, and Luke certainly includes it. So interesting. And each writer kind of places it for his purposes. Mark begins this chapter by telling us that Jesus went to Nazareth and could not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. They knew him so well that they didn't know him at all. The disciples are still going through that process. So it sets up this one picture of those who thought they knew Christ and did not receive the benefits of who he was because they didn't believe. It is important that they say, oh, this is the carpenter's son. He wasn't the carpenter's son. He was God's son. He was a carpenter's stepson. His mother, his brothers and sisters are here among us. Luke tells us, he went there where he was brought up, in Nazareth. He was brought up in Nazareth. Says he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath, as was his custom. Very important for us to see that, because there's a lot of kookaboos out there who tell you Jesus is one of the ascended masters when the hidden years. Well, those hidden years are something we made up. They're not hidden in the Bible. That he was in Tibet at some lamasery, flying around on carpets and learning where his inner third eye was. And the people said, oh, he's back from India. They didn't say that anywhere in the Bible. They said, yeah, we know this guy. He set our door jams and our window jams. He grew up here. He was brought up here. He grew up here. He went into the synagogue on the Sabbath, as was his custom. His brothers and his sisters are here. We know his family. We've watched him grow up. And the problem was they knew him so well, they didn't know him at all. And because of their unbelief, he couldn't do many mighty works there. Because it says he healed a few sick folk. Evidently, a few people came. But Jesus didn't go out in the middle of the street and said, bring me some sick people. Didn't happen. They knew him. Carpenter's son. Grew up there. Who does he think he is? Well, the disciples are still finding out who he is. He sends them out then, twos. Don't take a purse, don't take any bread, don't take extra shoes, extra clothes. Go, preach the gospel. If they receive you, wonderful, stay in the house. If they don't, shake off the dust of your feet. Raise the dead, heal the sick, preach the good news. And then it gives us another scene of a feast, but this feast is in the house of Herod. It is filled with drunkenness and sensuality. It is lavish. It is filled with everything that this world would set in front of someone in regards to wealth, in regards to sensuality, in regards to its feasts. And of course, you know the story. Salome is dancing and Herod is drunk. He's pickled and says, you know, I'll give you anything to the half of my kingdom. I'm sure Rome would have been glad to hear he was giving away Roman territory to a dancer, belly dancer, while he was drunk. But drunk people seem to give away a lot of things that belong to other people, don't they? Happiness. Home. Well, Herod's so impressed and says, just ask me whatever you want. Now, of course, Herodias tells her daughter, ask for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. That's why I love you, Mom. You know the whole story. Well, now it comes to the point where Jesus looks at the guys. The guys are spent. They're tired. They've been out. They come back. They're telling him about some of what their experiences were. And Jesus says to them, let's rest for a while. Let's go to a desert place. I like the fact that Jesus recognizes the need that we have to rest. I appreciate the fact that rest is holy, recognized by God, prescribed by Jesus Christ. Rest, again, a wonderful thing. I heard Warren Wiersbe say that he was going on vacation. A woman in his church gave him a hard time, said, the devil doesn't take a vacation. And Wiersbe said, I almost said if he could go with you, he would. But he said, I said to her, well, the devil doesn't need a vacation because he hasn't got a body. He's a spirit and he doesn't get tired. I'm dragging around this bag of bones and I need a vacation once in a while. Jesus said, let's go to a desert place. Now, this is not the Sahara Desert or the Mojave Desert. This is a deserted, the idea is isolated, it's solitude, a quiet place. And let's rest, which literally means to cease from labor. And we need to do that. You know, the kind of rest we need isn't, you know, Club Med. It's not being in one more busy place where there's spas and skin diving. You know, the kind of rest that human beings need is the kind of rest where there's solitude alone with Jesus Christ, where we cease from our own labors and we sit alone with him. That's the need for human beings. I mean, we live in a society that suffers from stress. You can eat all the fiber you want to, and you'll still die of a heart attack because of stress. Cholesterol ain't going to kill you. Stress is going to kill you. And we have more help to be stress-free than any generation. You know, people say, well, Abraham had servants. Well, he wouldn't have needed the servants if he had a dishwasher and if he had a refrigerator and if he had water running out of a pipe in his house. He wouldn't have needed the servants. You got all the servants he did. They're just not human. Well, and besides that, we have instant breakfast and instant on television and instant cameras and, you know, instant cereal and all. We have all of this stuff to save time so we can do more. We have more time-saving devices and are more stressed out than any generation that ever lived. Jesus says, come aside. Solitude, quiet place. Let's rest for a while. Now, the guys are excited about this. So they head across the Sea of Galilee. Now, if they're going from Capernaum to the area of Bethsaida, we understand today, it's about 4 miles. about 11 miles around on the shore. Now, the problem is with the Sea of Galilee, if you've been there, you know the whole perimeter is visible. There's hills all around it, about 7 miles across, 15 miles long. And the people are watching him. There he goes. No, that boat over there, that's him. They're all in there. I saw them leave. So the people, it says, start running. And the language, the grammar indicates that the crowd is building as they grow. They go from village to village. Where's everybody running? The master, the prophet, he said it this way. Oh, and everybody's taking off. The crowd's getting bigger. The disciples are in the boat thinking, oh, this is great. R&R. Finally, we're shot. Time alone with Jesus. I don't know what their discussion was like going across the lake. They're probably saying, oh, this is good. We're getting rest. We don't have to worry about a storm this time. We don't have to worry about demoniacs waiting for us on the other side this time. And the crowd outruns them, it says. And when they get around to the place where they were hoping for R&R, there's 10,000 people waiting for them on the shore there. Now, Jesus, it says, sees them as sheep without a shepherd, and he is moved with compassion. He never rests from compassion, and he never rests from love. He never rests from care. It says in Zephaniah chapter 3, in the kingdom age, when Satan is bound, he will rest in his love. You can't do that now. If you have children that are in a hostile environment somewhere, you can't rest as a parent, and you're not as good a parent as he is. So he's resting in the completed work on the cross, certainly, but he is not resting in his love. And he won't rest in his love till he has us all around him, home. And when he sees these people and their need, he sees them as sheep without a shepherd. Now, if you're an auto mechanic, you see cars. If you're a car salesman, you see cars. If you're an optometrist, you see glasses and eyeballs. If you're a shoe salesman, you see shoes. When Jesus looks at a crowd, he sees sheep, as he's a shepherd. And he sees them without care, the throngs, the multitudes. He sees much more than his disciples do. And it says, because of that, knowing that they have a hunger that's greater than a physical hunger, he teaches them many things. And evidently this teaching is going on for quite a while. The day begins to wane away, and the disciples say to him, Lord, it's getting late. Evening. They all look hungry to us. We formed a committee. Send them away. Let them go into the villages and buy themselves something to eat. And Jesus says to them, you give them something to eat. Let's feed him Peter. What do you mean? Give him something to eat. You know, you just sent us out earlier in the chapter in verse 8, told us not to take any bread, not take any provisions. Now you're telling us to feed 10,000 people. We don't understand. Now what Jesus is going to do, he's going to let them take inventory. He's going to let them measure their resources. He's going to let them look at the impossible. He's going to let them go through all of their mental planning. He's going to let them go through all that stuff. Because Philip's going to say, hey, you know, Lord, we don't have enough money. They're going to say, if we had 200 denarii, that's 200 days' wage, that's 8 months' wages. What is that today, $20,000, $30,000? If we had $20,000, $30,000, we couldn't do this. And even if we had $30,000, then we'd have to figure out where the bakeries are all over Galilee. We'd have to figure out which ones had the most loaves. We'd have to divide up into teams, and we'd have to form committees and groups, and we'd have to go out. We'd have to rent wagons from U-Haul to get all of that bread back here to do all, you know. In John chapter 6, verse 6, it says, Jesus said this knowing what he was about to do. You see, they never read the chapter before. I love this chapter. They're not saying, wait, do you see this? This is one of my favorite Bible stories. This is great. These guys are not happy campers. First he tells us, let's go away. First he tells us, let's be alone. Now he's telling us, feed 10,000 people. Send them away. You feed them. They're hungry. We don't have the money. You know, Judas. I thought we had more than that in there. What do you mean? You know, Judas is keeping the purse. Well, what do we have? Now, thank God there's a kid in the crowd. Because if an adult had these 5 loaves and 2 fishes, we would not have this story. A kid's naive enough to say, I'll share. You know, there's 2,500 people in here. Imagine four times this. I'll share five English muffins and two sardines. Everybody gets a little piece. An adult would have said, no, I'm not starting a riot. You know, just this, you know, just this will not be good. I'll just keep quiet and they'll all feel bad if they know I have food and they don't. There's a kid. Thank God there's a kid. And thank God there's a mom. Somewhere that morning in some house, when the crowds are running, some little kid's running out the door and the mom's saying, where are you going? Did you brush your teeth? Did you comb your hair? Did you clean your ears? Did you eat breakfast? Did you make a PBJ? Did you have lunch? Here. Five loaves and two fish. Some mom just being faithful. Had no idea she was going to feed 10,000 people that day. And this kid takes off running with the crowd. They all end up there together. Andrew comes and says, and John and says, well, we got five loaves and two fish. That's our resources. Jesus says, okay, make them sit down in companies. Divide them up into 50s and hundreds. Five loaves and two fish, good. Let's get moving. And the disciples must be thinking, this is not good. You know, you can imagine making 10,000 people sit down, because organizing 10,000 people on a hillside into 50s or 100s. Okay, here, that's about 50. You guys sit here, and some kid's saying, I want to see what my cousin, he's over there. You know, you can imagine what it was like dividing up people in the 50s and 100s. And they're sitting the people down. The people are saying, what are we going to do? Are we going to eat? The disciples are saying, I don't know what we're going to do. If they're all sitting down, we can get a running start, that's for sure. You know, the disciples don't know the story at this point. They're making people sit down to eat. In 50s and 100s. Jesus has this much food. How long did it take? It took long enough for them to think, and that's what Jesus wanted them to do, is to measure their resources. He wanted them to take inventory. Now, the beautiful thing about it is, they may not have the faith, but they have the obedience to move forward. You know, why should we build a boat? Noah, there ain't no water. Why should we walk around the walls of Jericho? That ain't going to do nothing. What do you mean? You know, we're carrying the ark. Put your foot in the water. I ain't swimming with this thing. It's made of gold. It's too heavy. How many times in the Bible is there some place when God is willing to accept obedience even though there's no faith? And where is the line between faith and obedience? I don't think it's easily understood. I think they blur together. There had to be some measure of faith for them to make everybody sit down and eat. Not enough faith to believe what was going to happen. But enough obedience to make it happen. And how many times in our life has God asked us to do something, or we see something in His Word, and we hear people saying, well, if I do that, I'll never get a husband. If I do that, I'll never get a wife. If I trust him with that, I'll never get a raise. If I'm honest about what I believe, this will never work out. If I share this with somebody, it'll never happen. If I give this away, we'll never make ends meet. And how many times is there where the Lord puts us in a situation to measure our resources, to measure what we're able to produce in and of ourselves, and the logic of His Word does not make a lot of sense to us, and we don't have faith to apply, but the Lord is still saying, then you obey. Give me obedience and watch what I will do in this circumstance. And maybe that is faith, obedience without evidence. Or maybe it can be obedience that is a little bit short on faith, but still acceptable to God. I don't know. They make them sit down, and then they come back. What now, Lord? He says, let's say grace. Imagine this, 20,000 hungry eyes staring at you. 5 English muffins and 2 sardines. God is great. God is good. Now we thank him for this food. No, that's not what he said. It says he blessed it. That is what it means. He said grace. But now a Jew would say grace a little bit differently. You and I today, when we say grace, we ask God to bless the food. That ain't a bad idea these days. You know, there's only 2 places in the New Testament that uses the word intercession. We talk about intercession, intercession, intercessors. I'm an intercessor. We talk about intercession like it's everywhere. It's one place where we're told to pray for rulers and kings and those in authority to intercede for them. Later, in Timothy, it says, in the last days, there will be those who tell us to abstain from foods that are meant to be received with thanksgiving and prayer. That word is intercession. So it says, not a bad idea in the last days to intercede over your food. Lord, take the strontium 90 out of this. Take the preservatives out of it. You know, take everything, you know, I need to eat. I don't like vegetables and antioxidants, so do that, Lord, for me so I don't have to eat broccoli or something. I don't know, you know. Not a bad idea. It's fuel. Help us be strengthened with this that we might serve you. Bless it, Lord. Touch it. Sanctify it. Ain't a bad idea. But as a Jew, Jesus was praying different. He wasn't praying to bless the food. He was blessing the provider. The Jew would look to heaven and bless God and thank God for the meal he had provided. Jesus is praying over that meal like, you know, he's looking to heaven saying, thank you, Father. Thank you for this meal. The disciples are up looking up and down, you know. Oh, they're going to partake of another kind of meal. They're going to find out he's not just the carpenter's son. They're going to end up with a different kind of rest than they wanted, but was far more important. Because Jesus knew that in the book of Acts, these men would face many circumstances with multitudes of people where their resources would not be adequate. They would be asked, well, if God's a God of love, why are there these hungry people? They would have something sown in their heart this day that would teach them there will be times when we will not have the resources that are adequate, when the mission seems impossible, where we need to stop getting out our accountants and taking inventory and adding up what we have, and we need to fall on our knees and we need to look to heaven for the supernatural. We have seen it. And we need to do the same thing today. Because the question that would be posed to Jesus are, what are these among so many? We have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. What are these among so many? And the answer of Jesus is the same now as it was then. Bring them here to me. Lord, this is all I have. I look at the Delaware Valley, greater Delaware Valley, 6 million people. Lord, how can my life ever account for anything? How can what I have to give or what I have to contribute, Lord, how can it ever mean anything? It's ridiculous, Lord. Look at the multitude, and I have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And the same response will come if we'll listen, and that is, bring them hither to me. Bring them to me. Jesus begins to say grace, blesses the meal. The guys are standing around, googly-eyed, watching this process. And then it says, he begins to break and to give it to the disciples. They begin to distribute it to the multitudes. Now, it's an interesting text because he begins to break as aorist, and he begins to distribute as imperfect. So one means he broke it. It can mean once and for all or instantaneously. He broke it once and for all, but he distributed it continually. He kept giving. And somewhere between the aorist and imperfect is the miracle. Somewhere between the one break and the continual giving in the hands of Jesus Christ is the miracle. Far different than healing someone. He's not fixing something up that was broken down. He's not repairing or restoring. He is creating. He is making molecules and elements that do not exist. It is the act of the Creator. It is setting him aside again from all of the other miracles he's done, except turning water into wine. And this is even different than that because he's producing something in volume that didn't exist. And the picture is that he's breaking. He breaks it once and then he just keeps giving from it. And he's filling up baskets. He's filling up the robes. They're going out to the people. They're passing each other in the crowd. You can see them coming back. They're sweating. They're saying to each other, "Do you believe what he's doing this time? I never thought, do you see what, can you believe it? I just want to stand there and watch him break it. I don't even want to go give it to the people. You know, hurry up. I want to go back before he runs out." Just imagine the conversation in the crowds, 10,000 of them, probably some of them don't even know what's happening. And it says that they all ate until they were glutted. That's when you can't breathe right. You know what it is. Don't act stupid. Don't look at me like, what's he talking about? You know, our lives have changed. We don't do a lot of the things that we used to do. We still glut once in a while. This is when you're at a restaurant, and we have our favorite restaurants, and some of them is not always quality, it's quantity. But it's the point in the meal where you're trying not to be noticed, loosening your belt under the table so you can breathe. And you're thinking, you're starting to sweat, thinking, I wish I was home with my sweatsuit on so I could, that's elastic in the waist. And the food has compressed your diaphragm and your lungs are just real small and you have to hyperventilate to breathe. And you think, I'm going to die. And the waitress says, would you like to see the dessert menu? I'll die. And your body's saying, I hope you do die. I can't believe you're doing this to me again. That's glutted. They're all leaning back. They can't sit forward. You know, there's 10,000 people glutted. I like it when Jesus feeds us that we're glutted. He doesn't give everybody, you know, a little piece and everybody's sitting around. Is there any more of that? You take it from your kid. He don't need that much anyway. Everybody, it says they eat until they can't eat anymore. 10,000 of them. And they're leaning back. I like the fact that God stoops down and says, in John, there was very much grass in that place. And in Mark, that it was nice and green. Of all of the things in the universe, God had prepared the place. And it was blanketed. Much grass. Very green. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. The great shepherd. Remarkable that God would take the time to tell us that. They could lay down when they couldn't breathe anymore. It was grassy and green. Now, the interesting thing as I look at the scene is that they all ate till they were glutted. And then Jesus says to his disciples, go gather up the fragments. And God had governed their glutting. Because it says there were 12 baskets full left over. Not 13. Jesus didn't need one. Not 11. Because someone ate one more time when they shouldn't have. Exactly 12. Each disciple at the end of the day, coming up to the top of the hill to sit down with Jesus Christ. Imagine as they finally all get there and look at each other and each man has a basket full. And what was the look on the face of Jesus as he looked into their eyes? And did each man bow his head and say, Father, thank you for providing. And were they more in wonder with his presence than they were with the food? What was it like? It was impressionable enough that it ends up in all four Gospels. It was a day that was engraved on them as they looked at him and saw something they had never seen before in his person. Realizing, you know, we're only distributors. We're not manufacturers. We're only distributors. We're not providers. We're not the cause. We simply give out. Same the day. I don't think it's changed. I look at it and I think, okay, Lord, how many times are there when we're in a circumstance, we don't have enough to go around, we're tempted just to say in the natural, this will never work, just send them away. We can't do this, we don't have enough. What is it that you want from us? What is it you wanted from them? And what is it you want from us 20 centuries later? Because, Lord, here we live in America. First of all, we don't ever have to worry about this because our refrigerators are full. There's probably 30 people in this room saying, come on, you blowhard, finish up so we can go to Friendly's and eat. But that's the society we live in. What is it he wants from us today? Why is it there? Why does he put it in front of us? Does he really want us when we see need, human need, to say, Lord, I'm not going to measure this by what I can produce, by what I can offer. I'm going to measure this, Lord, by what you can produce and by what you can offer. Lord, I can sit here for the rest of my life looking at what little I have and despise it, or I can hear your voice saying, bring that hither to me. And Lord, watch you break it and multiply it. I'm only a mom. I do the same load of wash every day. Lord, if you want to do a miracle, make it disappear. I hear the same, mom, give me this, mom, give me that every day. How can I be effective, Lord, in your kingdom? What do you have? You listen quietly, he's going to say, bring them here to me. Bring those kids here to me. Put them in my hand. I'm just a mechanic. I'm just a computer operator. This is all I have. Are we willing to listen? What if he says it to us? Bring it to me. Put it in my hands. Or what if it's, Lord, all I have is an insincere heart, Lord. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. I look around me. The harvest is great. The labors are few. I know all of the verses. And I know a few more, Lord. You can't get blood out of a stone. That's one of my favorite verses. Leopard can't change his spots. That's one of my favorite verses. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. That's one of my favorite verses. All my verses on impossibility, Lord. And all I do is gripe and complain. My heart is not what it should be. If you listen closely, you'll hear him say, bring it to me. Give it to me. I'm going to have the musicians come. We'll sing a last song together. Jesus was not just interested in providing bread and fish. He was providing something way above and beyond that in the lives of these men. They had realized sitting on that hill that day, this is not just the carpenter's son. They had realized sitting on the hill that day, this is the Lord, the Son of the Most High God. They had realized that day what real rest was. I guarantee you the rest they experienced at the end of that day with 12 baskets left over, looking into the face of Jesus, was more valuable to them than endless hours they could have spent alone in the wilderness somewhere. Let's stand, let's pray.